Hi, it's Sierra Miller. I can't wait for you to check out my new collection of shoes and accessories at Designer Shoe Warehouse. If you love shoes as much as I do, then trust me, I got you. From cute sneakerinas to the perfect flip-flops to stunning heels, these shoes are all style, no drama. It's a girl's girl summer, and DSW has just the shoes. Shop the Sierra Miller collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
I want to take you to a scene in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Men are in Confederate uniforms, women in antebellum hoop skirts. They're marching through the streets of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. This isn't a scene from the Civil War. This is Old South, an annual parade at the University of Alabama. It's hosted by one of the fraternities. Noticeably absent from the parade are any black men or women. Because at the time of this scene, fraternities and sororities remain segregated at the university. The year? It's 2013. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, the University of Alabama reckons with its segregated sorority system.
So I am from Alabama and went to University of Alabama from 2010 to 2014.
This is Abby Crane. She's a third-generation University of Alabama student.
Really, not a whole lot went into choosing my school. My dad went to Alabama, and my grandfather on my mom's side went to Alabama.
Abby grew up watching Alabama football, which has a nearly religious following. Ask anyone at Alabama, and they'll tell you that football is one of the two dominant forces on campus, the other being Greek life. Alabama actually has the largest Greek system of any university in the country, with over 12,000 members. To put that in perspective, Alabama has more Greek members than Notre Dame has students.
I want to say it's like 25 to 30% of the total student population, which honestly is less than you'd imagine, but it's just so visible. The sorority houses are right across the street from the stadium. The fraternity houses are the first thing you see when you drive into Tuscaloosa on campus. They're these huge antebellum-esque houses. Like, the visibility of them kind of shows the weight we put into it.
The fraternity and sorority houses look more like mansions. Many of them have Greek columns, grand staircases, and crystal chandeliers. They cost millions of dollars to maintain.
It's a literal manifestation of the worth we put into Greek life. Like, the social currency of Greek life was a really big deal. And I remember as a freshman, they'd be like, are you in a sorority? What sorority are you in? Like, that's immediately what they ask you. And like, there's an assessment someone can make from which sorority you're a part of.
The competition to get into one of these sororities is intense. Sorority recruitment, also known as rush, starts before freshman year even begins.
I was a senior in high school and was actually going to these things called pre-rush parties, where sororities will invite you to these group parties in your hometown. They'll memorize names before these parties. They'll have a list of attributes being like, she was homecoming queen, she was a national merit scholar. So they do know a good bit about like who you are if you're coveted by the sororities.
The recruitment process officially begins in early August, right at the start of the school year.
Early August in Alabama is the hottest of hot. It's like 90% humidity. No amount of hairspray can tame the frizz. You're dripping sweat.
Rush lasts for 9 days, broken up into several rounds. During the first round of rush, freshmen visit the sorority houses, where they're greeted by sorority members chanting in the doorway.
I remember showing up for my first house. Everyone stood in front of the doors. The doors flew open and they started singing a song, like yelling at us with these huge smiles and this huge hair and the head movements and the hand movements. Everything was so coordinated and exaggerated and girly.
Delta Gamma!
Once inside the sorority house, freshmen are pulled into a flurry of conversation with sorority members. Lots and lots of small talk.
You're carried around through each house having these conversations, and then you're filed out one by one, and they say your name as you leave. They say, goodbye, Abby, goodbye, Marco, whatever. Yeah, so you do that like 8 times a day.
It's exhausting, but you can't let it show because it's all about making a good impression. This process is so stressful for some freshmen that they hire consultants. What is a sorority consultant, you ask? Here's one of them describing her role.
I help them prepare for what they're going to be wearing for every single round. You know, just styling, like accessories, hair, makeup, nails, all that kind of good stuff. And then I also help them with conversation techniques.
And, you know, it's a big deal picking out the clothes. And like Southern style is canonically different than the rest of the world. Big poofy sleeves, big frills, bright colors, over-exaggerated silhouettes. You know, they're made for TV. They're made for social media.
It's not hard to see why sorority recruitment at Alabama regularly captures national attention. There's even an entire documentary about it called Bama Rush.
When people are earnest and serious about something that you know nothing about, it's fun to watch. And there's drama. Girls are crying. Not everyone gets what they want. There's winners and losers. And I think all of that makes a perfect kind of reality show of Rush.
Every year, videos from Alabama Rush invariably go viral on TikTok.
Rise and shine. Today's Saturday, the first day of Rush. This is my outfit.
It's really cute. So today is the first round of like us talking to girls. So like today is like the real deal, which is crazy.
If you've watched any of these clips, you might have noticed a striking trend. In each of the thousands of videos, nearly every single woman is white. To be fair, Rush videos from schools across the country are also predominantly white. But Alabama's numbers stand out. When Abby was rushing in 2010, Black women were still essentially barred from the 16 traditional Greek letter organizations. In fact, in the more than 100 years that sororities had existed at Alabama, only one identifiably Black woman had ever been accepted. The only other woman was half Black, but her ethnicity wasn't known until after she was admitted.
I'm pretty sure I remember noticing it was an all-white process, but I had never learned to question that yet. I went to school at a predominantly white high school in a pretty segregated city, so that was not something I was paying attention to.
That changed after Abby joined the student paper her freshman year.
We had a pretty diverse group. Our editor-in-chief was Black. And, you know, people were writing about race. People were writing about disparities in the South that, you know, as a white girl, I hadn't been paying attention to until it was kind of in my face.
Once she started paying attention, it was hard to miss. Throughout Abby's freshman, sophomore, and junior years, all 16 sororities remained entirely segregated. But then, at the start of her senior year, whispers began circulating that change might finally be on the horizon. June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples: breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. As we approach America's 250th anniversary, now might be the time to go back and learn how we got here. With more than 200 episodes, you can binge your way, decade by decade, defining event to defining event, from the founding into the 20th century. Join me, Professor Greg Jackson, for History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
The University of Alabama is the site of one of the most famous moments in the history of the civil rights era. In 1963, Alabama Governor George Wallace defiantly stood in the doorway of the university auditorium. He was symbolically trying to block Black students from desegregating the university.
As governor and chief magistrate of the state of Alabama, I deem it to be my solemn obligation and duty to stand before you, representing the rights and sovereignty of this state and its peoples.
Despite George Wallace's attempts, the Black students ultimately enrolled and made history. Fast forward 50 years, and history was set to be made again at the University of Alabama, this time in the sorority system. Because at the start of 2013, during Abby's senior year, there was buzz around campus about a standout candidate for sorority recruitment. Her name was Kennedy, and she was Black. Abby says that Kennedy had everything sororities at Alabama typically looked for. A 4.3 GPA, salutatorian of her high school class, and her grandfather was a prominent Alabama judge who even served on the university board of trustees.
Everyone was like, this girl, she is well-connected, she has these great grades, people in Tuscaloosa love her, she has a bunch of friends in the sororities.
The student paper, The Crimson White, was gearing up to write a story about Kennedy's acceptance.
It was expected to be this like celebratory story. Everyone was like, this is going to be a big deal. She's going to be the girl that changes things.
The Crimson White even had a photographer ready to capture the moment on bid day, the day when sororities extend invitations or bids to freshmen. Bid day is a big deal.
All the families come out and everyone's cheering for the girls that are running to each house, and boys in fraternities are handing them flowers. It's a community social thing to be celebrated.
But Bid Day 2013 didn't bring the anticipated celebration, because Kennedy didn't get a bid from a single one of the 16 sororities.
Everyone was just really surprised, and people were whispering, like, wow, something definitely happened.
Abby had since dropped out of her sorority, Alpha Gamma Delta, so she wasn't in the loop about what had happened. She started reaching out to a few old sorority sisters, but no one was willing to talk to the paper. Then she remembered a girl in the sorority named Melanie.
She was one of the few out-of-state girls in our pledge class. She was from Texas. You don't think of bastion of liberal ideas, Texas, but she grew up in a city. And so she came not caring about like the social do's and don'ts or the proper etiquette stuff. And I was like, well, if there was someone in that house who had something to say about it, it would have probably been her.
Abby was right. Melanie was willing to talk, and she shared everything that had gone down in Alpha Gamma Delta. She said the first round of Rush had gone as usual, 2 days of nonstop conversations with freshmen. But then things got strange. The Alpha Gamma sisters were supposed to vote on which freshmen to invite back for the next round. But that's when they heard from their alumni that there would be no vote. the alumni had already decided who would be invited back. As odd as it may seem, it's not unusual for sorority alumni, often middle-aged women, to have a say in which girls get bids. But in this case, the alumni had decided to eliminate Kennedy without the usual discussion and input from the current sorority members.
I'm a senior at this point. We're very low involvement in the rush process. So I'm like very not involved, but I live in the house at this time. So I'm hanging out at the house and there's like girls crying and just like really upset. And this one girl I'm close with that's younger was like, did you hear? Like, you know, there's like this girl that everyone wants, this black girl. And like, they're not taking because she's black. Like they're automatically nixing her. And everyone's like, isn't that crazy? And it's not going to be talked about. So I'm like getting fired up.
That evening, alumni held a meeting with the sorority members to discuss the next round of Rush. At first, the conversation carefully sidestepped the elephant in the room.
They don't want this to be discussed. They just are kind of like moving things along and they're like, okay, we're going to do this and this. And you know, this wraps up a great day. And I was like, are we not going to talk about the black girl that everyone has been talking about in the house all day?
The room fell silent until one of the alumni finally spoke up. She claimed that Kennedy had received a so-called negative letter of recommendation.
Meaning that somebody wrote a letter saying, you know, this girl is not good for your sorority. She did something bad. She's in bad news, something like that. Which is just like a lie, or she wrote it, or someone wrote it because they didn't want a black woman in the sorority.
One by one, women in the sorority began advocating for Kennedy.
So then like all these girls start speaking up and like saying all these things like, you know, we would love to be the first sorority to have a black woman. We would like stand up for her. You know, if fraternities didn't want to have parties with us, because that was always a big concern, you know, we wouldn't want to have parties with that fraternity anyways, but it kept going and going and it was going nowhere. And at the end of the day, like the alumni, older women were the ones that handle the paperwork and like send it in. So there's really nothing we could do.
When bid day came around, Melanie found out that Kennedy had been dropped from every other sorority as well. She says she wasn't necessarily shocked given the culture at Alabama.
There's just a general feel of like the old South. You would drive by some of the fraternity houses. They have a giant Confederate flag hanging in a window. You hear people actually say the N-word in a way that isn't like in a rap song or something. Like it could be a very scary place for a black person. And I remember bringing a friend from high school that was black to visit. And I was like, honestly nervous for her to like come into the sorority because it was entirely white women and black women were the women that served food to us. And it's just like, I was just worried for how she would feel.
But there was still a part of Melanie that had wanted to believe the sorority system was above all that.
Up until that moment, I think that most people wanted to believe it wasn't because they were black that they weren't getting in. It was just because like, they didn't have a mother, a great-grandmother that went there. They didn't have close friends that were in the sorority. Like, there were other reasons that they weren't getting in. But this particular situation, it was so black and white that it was because it was the color of her skin, because she had every other criteria to get in than that, that it was, like, hard to shy away from at this point.
It turned out that what had happened in Alpha Gamma Delta wasn't unique. Through conversations with women in various sororities, Abby and her co-writer learned that alumni in several chapters had similarly intervened to block Kennedy's admission. Some alumni even threatened to pull financial support if she were accepted. But in a few sororities, it was the undergraduate women who opposed admitting Kennedy. They worried that fraternities would stop socializing with them if they welcomed a black woman. Abby and her co-writer weren't all that surprised by what they were hearing. But what did surprise them was that sorority members were actually willing to talk to the paper. Here's Abby.
media training is a part of being in a sorority. It's very frowned upon to talk about what happens on the inside of sororities and fraternities, and no one likes to be a squeaky wheel.
The Crimson White's previous articles about segregation in Greek life didn't have any inside sources, and the articles weren't taken seriously as a result.
So many people had written stuff about Greek life, be it the racism, the hazing, all of that, but everything was able to be kind of chalked up to just jealous or like they don't know what it's like. But this story had people within the system calling it out.
To clarify, these sorority members were speaking to the paper on the condition of anonymity, but it was still a historic first, and the story was almost guaranteed to attract attention as a result.
I remember I talked to my dad, who was in a fraternity at Alabama. He was worried for me, like genuinely worried. I'm pretty sure he made a joke about someone's going to come burn a cross in your front yard or something. But it was more just like pissing people off for messing things with how the way things were and putting campus in a bad spotlight.
The story was threatening enough that the night before publication, Abby and her co-writer received a call from a fraternity member. He offered to pay them off to suppress the story. "Name your price," he said. That same night, Abby got another unexpected message, this time from Melanie.
I was keeping her updated on when it was going to publish, and the night before it published, I was like, it's going to publish tomorrow. And then she texted me back, put my name on that shit.
Meaning Melanie was going on the record. She wanted her name included in the article.
She was really brave for that.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
I hear a lot from people that there are days where it's hard to read a single news story. Forget actually being caught up. But I host a podcast that can fix that. It's called The Seven. Seven stories every weekday by 7 a.m. Eastern. And here's the other thing. It's short, less than 10 minutes, in fact. I'm Hannah Jewell. The Seven podcast will turn around your morning and get you caught up. Check it out and follow The Seven wherever you listen to podcasts.
They teach us in journalism school, you're never supposed to start a story with a quote. Everybody's tempted to do it, but it's usually not the strongest or correct choice for a story.
This is Matt Ford, Abby's co-writer at The Crimson White. "Are we really not going to talk about the black girl?" read the opening line of the article.
But this was one exception because it speaks to the core issue of what so many people on campus felt about it. You know, are we really not going to talk about this?
The article was published on September 11th, 2013. It was titled "The Final Barrier: 50 Years Later, Segregation Still Exists."
We were working on it till super late, like I want to say till maybe 2 or 3 a.m. And I remember waking up the next morning, had a bunch of messages from friends, family, etc.
This is Matt Ford, Abby's co-writer on The Crimson White.
Newspaper stands on campus were empty, like all the papers had been taken. And I don't know if that was just from students grabbing them to read them or if the Greeks who opposed us publishing it were just trying to get them off the stands.
The Crimson White website crashed after the article went up. Matt initially thought they'd been hacked before realizing the true cause, the sheer volume of people trying to access it at once.
We expected it to make some waves, especially on campus, because the paper had never had active members of sororities, especially the certain group of sororities, speak publicly, especially with one member going on the record with her name, Melanie, taking us into the chapter room and what happened there. And so we knew that was going to cause waves on campus and maybe like in the, you know, immediate area. We did not expect the national media coverage that came with it.
Melanie Gotts thought this year, her last at the University of Alabama, would be the year a black student would be invited to join Alpha Gamma Delta.
The article went viral on Twitter, and pretty soon national reporters descended on campus to cover the story. Reporters from the New York Times, USA Today, BuzzFeed.
The days after feel almost like a blur because it got so big so quickly. Reverend Jesse Jackson came to campus. CNN came to campus and interviewed us.
Abby Crane and Matthew Ford, two editors at the campus paper, broke the story, and it is fueling conversation beyond the campus. Even the governor is weighing in.
Amid the media onslaught, the national chapter of Alpha Gamma Delta came to campus to have a word with Melanie.
And they were like telling me not to do any more media, just not get any more attention, and seemed like it was a terrible thing. And on the other hand, it was like I had women in my sorority messaging me, thanking me, and black women that had gone to Alabama and Rush and were dropped, like thanking me.
Matt, meanwhile, encountered some less than pleasant reactions from students on campus.
I got threatened at bars. There were dumb, drunk frat boys who, you know, definitely made their opinions known.
As for the university administration's response, nobody on campus knew what to expect.
I kind of described the culture at the university as like a PR culture because they were so afraid of addressing or trying to actually take on any like hard issues. It just always felt like they were sweeping everything under the rug. But I think it kind of reached a breaking point where students were saying, no, we're not just going to not talk about this anymore. Like, it needs to be brought up and addressed.
This time around, the administration couldn't remain silent. Less than a week after the article's publication, University President Judy Bonner addressed the segregation in the Greek system.
Today, the eyes of the nation are once again on the University of Alabama. Chapter members admit that during the recruitment process, decisions were made based on race. The University of Alabama is taking the unprecedented step of opening up the continuous open bidding process.
President Bonner instructed the all-white sororities to reopen their bidding process to new members. This meant that sororities could now extend bids at any time throughout the year. In theory, it created the opportunity to admit black members, but it didn't mandate it.
While we will not tell any group who they must pledge, the University of Alabama will not tolerate discrimination of any kind.
Not everyone was satisfied with this response. There were no measures in place to track progress, for one, and nothing was being done about the fraternities. The day after President Bonner's announcement, hundreds of faculty members and students, both from inside and outside Greek life, gathered to protest segregation on campus. In a nod to 1963 and George Wallace, they carried a banner that read, "The final stand in the schoolhouse door."
I think it's kind of sad, but really notable and poignant that it was the students who led that change and not the adults. And just really, again, speaks to that culture on campus. Like, the adults felt, especially like some members of the administration, were petrified to like rock the boat. So it just became like, all right, well, if you're not willing to do it, then it's going to be us.
By the spring, at least 10 black women were admitted to traditionally white sororities, including Kennedy.
My understanding from chatting with friends here and there since then is that the sororities, and now the fraternities as well, although to a lesser extent, do pledge people of color. And now, you know, a significant barrier that hasn't been crossed, but to the extent they're actually welcoming it, I'm not sure.
A few years after graduating, Abby went back to campus for a football game.
You know, on game days, all the sorority girls wear these pins with their sorority letters on them, like Kappa Gamma loves the Tide or AOPI loves the Tide. And I remember seeing a black girl with a pin on. And I remember that felt really big. Like, you just didn't see that. That was like a visual representation of the change. But at the same time, I mean, you've seen the Bama Rush TikToks.
Technically, the historically white sororities are now integrated. And in 2023, Black members made up 0.7%.
I don't blame these teenagers on TikTok who are, you know, going through the motions and putting on their cute clothes and cosplaying a Southern Belle because that's what you do to maintain your proximity to power. Granted, you don't know you're doing that at the time. I didn't know that that's what I was doing at the time. Sororities, Greek life, were created to be exclusionary social clubs. That's the whole point of them, is to be exclusionary. So I don't really see a point in marking change since then, because it's never going to change and it will never be these bastions of progressive thought and diversity of opinion. That's not the point. The point is to teach people the social rules and give them access to power and maintain that power.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Margot Gray. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprungkaiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.